L-E-T-E-N-P-C.
Your night in just got legendary. Get ready to chase the rush, spin, win, and redeem instantly straight to your bank account at legendswithaz.com. With free-to-play slots, blackjack, keno, roulette, and more, experience all the thrills of Vegas without leaving your couch. Legends has it all.
Legends is a free-to-play social casino. Nope. Void where prohibited. Must be 18 plus. Play responsibly. Visit legends.com for full details.
Get in the game now and score a 50% bonus on your first purchase only at legendswithaz.com.
This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor. It is 1939. Frank Haig is the very powerful boss of Jersey City. He has prohibited the Committee for Industrial Organization from picketing on private property in order to explain his views of the newly adopted National Labor Relations Act. I learned this from Richard Epstein, Professor Richard Epstein of the Hoover Institution, a senior fellow writing at Defining Ideas. Richard teaches law at NYU and the University of Chicago. This is a magical moment because here we begin the discussion about what is the authority to protect picketing, to protect free speech, to protect the protest of national emergencies, and the powers of the court. Richard, a very good evening to you. The Supreme Court made a decision in 1939. What does it teach us about the most recent controversy about picketing or protesting against national concerns? In this instance, it would be the Supreme Court. Good evening to you.
Yes, look, it's a very complicated tale. But the earlier position, sort of adopted in the late 19th and earliest 20th century, is that when the government owned private property, it owned it like any other person, and it could admit or exclude anybody whom it wanted for any reason at all. Basically, it was like a castle. What the Haig decision said is no, the operative matter when you're talking about government-owned property is that the government is a public trustee and that all the citizens in the community are beneficiaries of that trust. And so what happens is you then try to figure out what limits this puts on the government's power. And the first thing you come up with is they cannot simply exclude people from the public area when they wish to protest as a matter of right. What they have to do is to explain why it is that some kind of time, place, or manner restriction is appropriate in order to protect against various forms of violence. And so what you do, in effect, is you now say that public property is very different from private property because private property is not subject to the trust obligations, and public property most surely is. So what you then start to do, you say, okay, well, that means that you have to show cause. What is it going to be? Well, you start looking at what's going on in the Haig case. It's extremely instructive to recognize that first this was a perfectly bona fide political protest. There was a very strong union, the CIO, now part of the AFL-CIO, and they wanted to explain to everybody what they thought the benefits under the collective bargaining statute passed in 1935 were to workers and to organize. And the idea that you could stop this would be crazy. If, in fact, you could show that they were trying to storm the gates or to intimidate people one way or another, at that point you would start to have cause. So that's the basic framework that you want to deal with, and it's the one, I think, which for the most part makes sense. So that's the background. Then the question is, we now move forward, and it's a rather different landscape. What you do is you have the private presence of a Supreme Court justice. What happens is the pickets want to get on the public streets. You could look at some of the pictures, and they basically are putting them in criminal file. They have bullhorns that are available. They want to make noise. The whole purpose here is not to inform the public, which you could do in 1,000 other different locations. It's an act of outright intimidation with respect to what's going on at that particular place. So even though you accept that there's a public trust doctrine and that allows people to protest, the public trustee also has to operate, has obligations to make sure that when people do come, they don't trespass on the rights of other individuals. And so what happens is, at this particular point, you could think of it in one of two ways. You can say that residents are different from business places and that there's a real invasion of privacy when you haunt these situations. Or you can say it's not the residents that's decisive, it's the target of the person, and that to picket a Supreme Court justice in the effort to influence some kind of future decision is an effort to upend the independence of the judiciary with various kinds of coercive thoughts. And I think both of those arguments are perfectly applicable in this case. And what you then see is there's a very strong reaction. Everybody wants to pass the buck. The state people say, well, you got to do this at the federal level because a statute which singles out various kinds of areas for special treatment is unconstitutional under the First Amendment. And then you get the administration saying, look, you know, we understand that we have to provide protection for these people, but that doesn't mean that the protection we have to provide is to move people away from the front of the house. We'll just put extra guards there. Well, this is really quite wonderful. You're sitting in a house, and instead of having just 1,000 protesters outside your door, you throw on top of that 200 cops, and you're trying to figure out, well, what are you going to do next when your children want to come home and so forth? And so I regard the states as having a bad constitutional analysis of what's entailed, and I regard the federal government and the attorney general as being just feckless. I will say in parentheses, there's been no bigger disappointment in the Biden administration than the Attorney General Merrick Garland, who turns out to be faceless and utterly incapable of standing up to anybody who's on his own side. We know what his political prejudices are, because if you look at the statement that he issued shortly after the Dobbs case came down, it was, we will do everything within our power to make sure that we can negate that state by trying to say that anything the federal government wants to do preempts anything that the state government wants to do. So he's not a disinterested partisan in this case, and that's what dangerous if you have, is you get somebody who's absolutely rabid against what happened in Dobbs, and now he's in charge of protecting the judges who wrote those decisions. I think that's an extremely uncomfortable position to be in, and yet are you going to ask whether a Supreme Court justice is going to go to court, really require the attorney general to make sure that he removes people from in front of their house? That itself is an extremely fraught and dangerous kind of activity. Whole system's broken down.
Let's look at a colleague of yours you mentioned in your reporting for Defining Ideas, Jonathan Turley, a very well-known, outspoken law professor at George Washington. He has recommended that the demonstrators, the protesters, the people marching in with signs, are expressing freedom of speech, and that that is to be allowed under the First Amendment. Now, the puzzle here is that's a surprising interpretation from common sense point of view. I'm not a law student. I mentioned most recently some courts, not the Supreme Court, some courts have had presented to them another issue where freedom of speech is surprisingly applied in what appears to be an aggressive, an aggression. This is the BDS movement that is now arguing, argued by the ACLU to be freedom of speech, and inhibiting BDS is said to be violating the first rights of the people advancing freedom of speech. I mention that because apparently there is fresh wind that says freedom of speech is any opinion you have and any conduct you have. Is that is that applicable here in the case of the court?
Well, I think Curley, basically, he's generally pretty sound. I thought he lost his mind in this particular situation. His argument was twofold. One is that, well, you're stopping certain kinds of pickets at certain places and not others, and that what has to happen is you have to have equal treatment across all cases. There's a case called Mosley against the Chicago Police Department decided in 1972 that announced that principle, and it's basically wrong in my view. What happens is, if you're dealing with either political protest on abortion or on labor disputes, historically they present very distinct problems, and what you do is you basically then try to have a regime which includes damages and injunctions against the use of force applicable to that situation. And what Mosley said is you can't use a regime which will punish one kind of pickets unless you punish all kinds of pickets. And since labor people were exempted from the statute was unconstitutional with respect to everybody else. Now, the mistake in that is as follows. The key issue with respect to government force is whether or not when the government exerts influence in a particular dispute, it takes sides with one party or another in terms of the content of what's being presented. And so if you had a rule which says that pro-union picketers could go freely about and anti-union picketers could not, that would be clearly unconstitutional. But these two subject matters are completely unrelated, and there's absolutely no reason to say that if you've got a series of problems with either abortions or labor statute that need direct regulation, you can't regulate that unless you regulate everything under the sun. And what Justice Marshall did, that is, Thurgood Marshall did, was make a big boner mistake, as far as I'm concerned, in 1972, when he says that you have to have the same rules across subject matters as you do across rival parties. The former is simply not appropriate. And indeed, the reason they exempted the labor pickets, if you go back to the Hague case, Justice Owen D. Roberts said, that was the justice then, he said, you know, labor disputes are really special. And that's why we have to work through these rules. So on the one hand, they're special. On the other hand, they're not special. You can't have both documents. And so they've done it. So that was the first mistake, I think, that was made with Mosley. The mistake that Turley made, I think, is actually very serious. He says, well, you know, if they picketed before Dobbs, then they're trying to influence the decision. But if they picket after it comes down, they're not trying to influence the decision. That requires a degree of myopia that is not to be accepted. It's very clear that there will be an enormous amount of follow-up litigation that's going to come, and that when these guys are out there, they're not saying to the Supreme Court, we would like you to look at this in a disinterested fashion. They're saying anything that you do which advances the cause of the pro-life movement, we're going to terrorize and object to. Anything you do on the other side is what we want. So they are basically in this game for the long run. And if they're in the game for the long run, then it's intimidation for the long run. And, you know, if these people started to send hate mail messages to the Supreme Court justices on email, I think people would say, well, this is wholly improper. And the same thing is here. I have no objection for these people going anywhere else they want in order to reach the public at large. There are a billion ways you can do that without engaging in direct forms of intimidation. But the moment they start making this personal to the people, then it has gone beyond the situation that's appropriate, and some sanctions ought to be applied. So this First Amendment interpretation that was taken in Maryland is just, I think, 100% wrong. And the Garland position, I think, is 100% wrong. So what we do is we now have essentially a runaway First Amendment. This is something I, by the way, predicted some 20-odd years ago when I wrote this article on First Amendment exceptionalism, saying, look, what the First Amendment is about is making sure that classical liberal norms are not going to be deviated from in a way that allows you to suppress speech which does not involve the use of force, fraud, or monopoly. The First Amendment was never designed to say that what you could do is insulate all sorts of speech, even when it involves the threat of force. And so the whole question about the First Amendment has always been, how do you decide what is a threat? Does it have to be clear and present? Can it be remote but more serious and all the rest of that stuff? How does this tie into the law of conspiracy and intimidation? These are very hard questions, and we face them for a very long period of time, not entirely satisfactory, I might add. But what they're arguing for is something completely different, which is that the whole stuff that speech stops when essentially force and fraud are now in the offing, that's not something they want to believe. They think that until you kill somebody, intimidation is perfectly okay. And I think that that's really major threat.
Let me see if I understand this. In the BDS case, boycott is not freedom of speech. In the Supreme Court case, intimidation is not freedom of speech. Is that correct, Richard?
Yeah. A boycott is a collective refusal to deal. It's a violation of the Sherman Act. Any one person deciding not to do business with you is just competition, because there are other people who could take it. But if you get everybody who's relevant and say, either you do what we want or we're going to shut you down, ever since Sir Matthew Hale wrote about this subject in the late part of the 17th century, it's been understood that that's
essentially it. And so therefore that doesn't apply to the First Amendment, and protesting at a Supreme Court justice's house doesn't apply to the First Amendment. Is that where
And you know, there is a very controversial set of decisions. Is can you go to a courthouse before the Supreme Court and start yelling and screaming? Is that going to be protected speech? And the Supreme Court has generally said no, given the fact that there's the danger of the interruption of justice. Other people have said, well, this is a little bit too hysterical. They're not inside. They're not threatening anybody. But it's very different from going and having a 30-minute demonstration in front of a courthouse and then going day after day and night after night in front of somebody's home and make it so that they, in effect, have a living hell inside the doors. And this is not just an inadvertent consequence of what's happening. This is the sole purpose and aim of what they're doing. And you can't run a system in which one side is going to play by the Marcus of Queensbury rules and not engage in that kind of stuff. And I'm not aware of any of the pro-life groups who've gone to the houses of the three dissenting justices and started to picket in front of them. You can't run a system in which progressives are essentially now immunized from all of the general rules that govern these kinds of cases.
Professor Richard Epstein of the Hoover Institution, writing and defining ideas. We're going to turn to another remarkable a piece of legislation from the 20th century. It's called Title IX when we come back. I'm John Batchelor.
Stay tuned for more of CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.
You're great at protecting your own personal information. You probably even use things like two-factor authentication, strong passwords, and a VPN. But as much as you try to be in control of how your information is protected, there are lots of places that also have it, and they might not be as careful as you are. That's why LifeLock monitors millions of data points every second for identity threats. If your identity is stolen, a LifeLock U.S.-based restoration specialist will help solve identity theft issues on your behalf, guaranteed, or your money back. Plus, all LifeLock plans are backed by the $1 Million Protection Package, meaning LifeLock will reimburse you up to the limits of your plan if you lose money due to identity theft. You might not be able to control how others handle your personal information, but you can help protect it with LifeLock. Save up to 40% your first year. Call 1-800-LIFELOCK and use promo code IHEART or go to LifeLock.com/iHeart for 40% off. Terms apply.
Your night in just got legendary. Get ready to chase the rush, spin, win, and redeem instantly straight to your bank account at legendswithaz.com. With free-to-play slots, blackjack, keno, roulette, and more, experience all the thrills of Vegas without leaving your couch. Legends has it all.
Legends is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Must be 18+. Play responsibly. Visit legends.com for full details.
Get in the game now and score a 50% bonus on your first purchase only at legendswithaz.com.
There's nothing like sinking into luxury. At washablesofas.com, you'll find the Anabe sofa, which combines ultimate comfort and design at an affordable price. And get this, it's the only sofa that's fully machine washable from top to bottom, starting at only $699. The stain-resistant performance fabric slipcovers and cloud-like frame duvet can go straight into your wash. Perfect for anyone with kids, pets, or anyone who loves an easy-to-clean, spotless sofa. With a modular design and changeable slipcovers, you can customize your sofa to fit any space and style. Whether you need a single chair, love seat, or a luxuriously large sectional, Anabe has you covered. Visit washablesofas.com to upgrade your home. Right now, you can shop up to 60% off store-wide with a 30-day money-back guarantee. Shop now at washablesofas.com. Add a little to your life. Offers are subject to change and certain restrictions may apply.